wander in as they please, and we put some of our books up here for you to, for your delectation and delight. And we have several items on the agenda today. We'd like to do a bit more with the readings that some of you are working on. We want to open up the discussion respecting the video, PBS video, which we saw yesterday of her life, for any questions or comments that you may have. A number of you saw it. And then we have an audio tape that we would like to play, which is another medium through which Emily Dickinson's poetry has often been very successfully and artistically presented. So, why don't we see, to start off, if there are some of the readings that folks would like to pair up and read as we started with yesterday.
Let's move this back so we have a little space.
Sure. Okay.
Is it help?
No, I don't think so. We're used to moving things around.
Or you got to practice stuff this morning.
That's right. That's right. Yes, we were on the garbology team.
Were you really? Oh.
Yes.
What does that mean exactly? What are your duties, would you tell us?
It's interesting, yeah. And you go through all
bread in one stack, beans in the other, or what do you do?
Yeah, and paper, plastic,
burnable things.
Mysterious.
Other vegetables.
The next step is to write an article for the Inquirer on the private lives of the people.
Absolutely. You get little snippets of people who know.
Yes, we hear, for example, there are comments being made by a staff member saying, whose handwriting is that?
Whose handwriting?
Why did she write that to him? So one must be careful.
Life in a small town.
Life in a tiny town.
And then, it's really interesting. And then, some stuff all goes into a compost area, which is actually not functioning too well. So that's rather odoriferous. And cardboard boxes all get packed up together. It's interesting.
Are you talking about Bellevue?
No,
we're talking about the garbology team at Holden Village. So let us take stock of those who did pick poems to read, which were then grouped with others. Are there some of you who would like to do some of that?
Peggy and I are a team.
Why don't you start us off?
But if you skip us, that's all right too.
Yeah. No.
Oh, come on.
What's your preferred order?
The family. We're in family.
All right.
We decided that I would be first.
All right. Proceed, please.
Because this is her happy time. One sister have I in our house, and one a hedge away. There's only one recorded, but both belong to me. One came the road that I came, and wore my last year's gown. The other, as a bird in her nest, builded our hearts among. She did not sing as we did. It was a different tune, herself to her a music, as bumblebee of June. Today is far from childhood, but up and down the hills, I held her hand the tighter, which shortened all the miles.
Eden is that old-fashioned house we dwell in every day, without suspecting our abode until we drive away. How fair, on looking back, the day we sauntered from the door. Unconscious our returning, discover it no more.
What do we see as the relationship between the two?
In the poem that I read, she was totally happy being at home, wandering up and down the hills. It was a tribute to her new sister-in-law, the reason that she wrote the poem. In Peggy's poem, as we read it, you can wander afar looking for this Eden when you already have it at home. And she also points out that you really can't go home again if you do leave. She's contented being where she is at that point in her life.
Maybe that's why she didn't leave.
She knew that this was Eden.
She'd already found her goal.
How old was she?
This was a very early poem.
I don't know, but...
Does it have the date of the farm on there? Some of them do.
No.
56.
So we've got the big ones.
Yeah, let's just take a look. Probably that she was born in 1840. We'll get the date of the farm, and that'll tell us how old she was.
1856, about approximately nine, because her brother and sister-in-law were married.
Had just gotten married.
Yes, right.
And yours starts out Eden?
Eden. Anyway, that was our interpretation of what it meant.
Other thoughts on it?
I'd like to hear the Eden one again, because I kind of didn't get it.
It's a little more oblique, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yeah. Do you want to give us the Eden one?
Eden is that old-fashioned house we dwell in every day, without suspecting our abode until we drive away. How fair, on looking back, the day we sauntered from the door, unconscious our returning, discover it no more.
Oh, when I heard that the first time, I saw it more like, you know, you think, you live your life, and then looking back, you think, oh, but it was more wonderful then. That's kind of the way I saw that. Not that you can't go home, but that looking, we think it's more wonderful back then than it really was.
Well, that could be anyway.
I don't think she's saying then it really was.
In her circumstance.
That may be what our experience has told us to be the case, but I'm not sure that she's saying that. I think rather she's saying, seems to me, as you suggested it, this is the place where everything was perfect. A childhood home, for example. We call our childhood homes rose-colored glasses, don't we? Most of us, particularly one house.
But once you wake up, then what?
Well, if you go back there, it's not going to be the same. It's changed, which is another way of saying you can't go home again.
Well, then what, is she saying then that she maybe left, symbolically she really left then? Because how could you come back if you've never left? Am I confusing?
Well, it could be just a journey in time. I mean, if she were talking, say, if she addressed this to her sister, or to her sister and her brother, and was saying...
Come on in.
When we were children, we lived in a kind of Eden. But then we left that. Then what happens to the pony?
She actually did make a move, too. The house in which she lived most of her life was several blocks from the house in which she lived as a tiny child. She moved, I'm going to say, at the age of 10 or 12, to the homestead, the place where she spent the rest of her years. But she always looked back on that other house as the ideal place. So this may have some bearing here, that you look back on your childhood place, or any place where you've been previously, especially as a child, I think, as perfection.
Now, had I not known anything about her background, which I truly didn't before I came to this class, I may have interpreted it a little bit differently than I did after hearing about.
In what way might you have interpreted it differently?
Well, I might have interpreted that, you know, you had gone away, you know, and maybe been gone for many years or something, and had this wondrous image of what life had been and how it had been, and then you go back and you can't recapture it, and it's not the same. Then, you know, knowing her history now, or her background, I got a little different feeling for it.
I interpreted that Eden is already here. We have it, but we're not always, we're oblivious to the fact that we've got it. And so the great search to find this perfect place.
We have it all the time.
Yeah.
And she knew that.
That's what I thought.
Right. And you can make your journeys without actually physically going to a different place. For example, she did, through art, through literature, through creativity.
That was the line you quoted in the beginning of this group today, about the journey in the mind.
Yes.
Yeah.
Right. Other comments on the...
Did you find out what year she wrote that?
Unknown.
Unknown.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was first published in 1914, but they don't know the date.
She didn't date them.
She dated a lot of them, but then there's a whole bunch.
They were able to, glean the approximate date, because happily for the researchers, her hand changed her handwriting changed quite markedly at different periods of her life.
Maybe that's when her eyes were failing.
Could very well be a product of her problem with her eyes, yes indeed, which was a recurring and continuing difficulty.
I wondered, when did her mother become ill? Was her mother always an invalid from her early childhood, do you know?
No, she was not. It was when Emily was a mature woman.
Oh, so she was a child then, her mother was a present to her.
She was. I thought the television, the video, was a little bit deceptive in that respect, because as she was a growing up young girl, her mother was indeed the mistress of the house. And it was only later that her sister and she took over the functions because of her mother's health problems.
She said all her time was taken up with serving Mama. And I wondered how soon that started.
Yeah, it didn't start until Emily was well into her 30s.
Oh,
certainly, and I think into her 40s. Wasn't true when they were young girls. So I thought that was just a little bit, one of the few things about that video that was a little bit off, I think, in the impression that it left. But her mother was not a very strong person, was not a very forceful personality. She was much more a passive person than the father, who was an extremely powerful man.
Did she mention, or did you mention, maybe that's where I've been misconstrued, because I did get the feeling. She said someplace, I never had a mother.
Right, yeah, she wrote that.
She wrote that, and that too is, I think, subject to misinterpretation. What she really meant was that her mother was not a strong presence. And was not the influence that the mothers of her girlhood friends were. She was really rather a weak kind of a, not very forceful personality. And the father was who she was the quintessence of the New England wife, subservient to the husband, and particularly the husband, such a strong character, and took an interest in all that was happening in the household. So it was he who was the forceful personality, and she was very meek. That's what she meant, pretty much.
She apparently maybe didn't think. She apparently objected to a lot of that Puritan culture, and maybe she thought her mother was a victim of it.
I think so.
She wanted no part of that. Huh?
Yeah.
And her mother may have been, you know, one of those women who
sickly.
Yeah, it was sickly, and the sickliness was.
The sickliness was very prevalent.
Right. It was written. Yeah. It was presumably a kind of psychic state that 19th century women got into.
If you don't get any attention and you're passive, if you need attention through sickness, that's one way to get it.
That's one way to get it.
That wasn't unusual.
Right. Mm-hmm. It was quite common.
For a woman.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Other comments on these two poems?
Before we just leave that, I love that line, which is in the film about she. You know, the affection came, I can't remember.
When she became our child, the affection came.
When she became our child, the affection came.
I love that too.
When the girls started to take care of their mother. Yeah.
That's role reversal.
Role reversal, but then.
She learned to love her mom.
They learned to love each other. Yeah. So the last year of her mother's life, when her mother was bedridden.
I thought that
they became very close.
Very moving.
Yeah.
But we shouldn't assume that there was a rift between them, or there was a lot of light showing between them. It was a post-mother-daughter relationship, but Emily had this waspish, rather strong way of stating things, and she's putting her mother down there.
She must have had, her mother might have had a little trouble with her. She must have been a hard kid for her mom.
Everybody had trouble with her. She was not an easy kid to raise and an easy sister to have. Nor an easy suitor, nor an easy person to visit, as we saw. She was such a powerful personality and such a an articulate and a puzzling person.
You know, it was kind of wonderful to have Joyce Carol Oates in that video.
She seemed to contrast to me.
Well, I thought she was probably much like Emily.
Oh, did you really?
Were this really smart, kind of intolerant of.
Well, I'm talking about her appearance. The Emily's didn't have a hair out of place on her head. You know, this woman looked
cool. Well, with that same kind of little tight little face and thinking about things and really articulate, and you felt very little tolerance for people who weren't as quick as she was. Mm-hmm. I mean, I can just see her going after a student in a class, and it's pretty devastating. Who didn't see the video? We shouldn't keep talking about it.
So there are several people here who didn't see. It's an hour-long PBS video that we showed yesterday of her life.
Is it in the library?
It's not in the library here, but you could probably get it in any public library, because it was part of the Views and Voices and Visions series that PBS did, which is a very good series. And so I think you can get it in any public library or university library, I'm sure. And it is good. Yeah, we were impressed with it.
If there are no other comments on these two, shall we move to...
Oh, no, I want to do this one. I want to set it up.
You want to set it up and do it again? Go ahead.
Because I think it would be fun to do it. Let's give you...
I'm not an actor. Okay, what do you want me to do? I'll try.
I want to give you your two sisters.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. So let's give her a couple of sisters.
Okay.
Okay, go there, and let's put a sister there, and a sister...
Sister on either side?
Sister on either side, yeah. So let's give her a Vinny and a...
Susan.
Okay, so we're going to hold you in abeyance. So let's have the two new ladies come and be... Which one knit?
I'll pick a pass on.
You
don't have to say a word.
I'll sit right here.
Okay, you make you. You be the sister-in-law. You be the sister-in-law over next door. Okay?
I don't know what's going on at all. I'm totally...
We're just recreating.
Oh, Vinny, how are you?
Vinny. In order to make them clear, we're putting them in a situation that was clear to them. So this is Emily Dickinson talking about her sister-in-law who lives next door. And her sister. And so it's just to help her.
I see what expression I should have on my face.
Make the poem as clear as possible, that we put it in some physical context. So you're just the sister-in-law next door.
Okay. You can be right there next door.
Right there.
That's where you are.
But this is going to help her read the poem, and then you can actually indicate your sisters and where they are and what they're doing. And you can be the brother. Okay, so you have a brother and you two live next door.
And you're married.
And you're married to each other. You live right in the house next door.
Oh, sweetheart.
It wasn't the happiest of marriages, but...
Oh, dear.
Am I happy with her?
Sure you are.
Oh, yes.
We adore
yes,
each other.
Yes, indeed.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Happy then.
Yeah. And so just take your time with the poem. And you can actually physically indicate who you're talking about, and let the pictures come clearly to you.
One sister have I in our house, and one's ahead your way. There's only one recorded, excuse me, but both belong to me. One came the road that I came, and wore my last year's gown. The other, as a bird in her nest, builded our hearts among. She did not sing as we did. It was a different tune. Herself to her a music, as bumblebee of June. Today is far from childhood, but up and down the hills, I held her hand the tighter, which shortened all the miles. Whose hand am I holding? I think I'm holding Sue's.
I think so too. And so maybe you want to actually get up and move over toward her on that last part of the poem.
Today is...
And what is the, she has a bird in the nest?
Yeah, she builded herself as a bird in the nest. She built herself in my heart because I grew to love her like the little bird building her nest.
Okay.
I thought she was pregnant.
Yeah. I did too, personally.
So where do you want me to start again?
So why don't you start at the beginning and why don't you do it on your feet? I think it's going to help you to
Shall I stand up too?
Well, you can sit.
I'm better sitting.
Yeah, you're better sitting.
Right. One sister have I in our house, and one a hedge away. Oh, golly. I forgot you're at the hedge. One sister have I in our house, and one a hedge away. There's only one recorded, but both belong to me. One came the road that I came and wore my last year's gown. The other as a bird her nest, builded our hearts among. She did not sing as we did. It was a different tune. Herself to her a music, a bumblebee of June.
Today is far from childhood, but up and down the hills, I held her hand the tighter, which shortened all the miles.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Very nice.
Oh, that's nice.
Oh, poor Vinny.
Wow.
You might have gotten married. Did Lavinia ever get married?
She did not.
Oh.
I'm jealous of my sister.
Okay, that's what happens.
let's see what we can do with your poem. Actually, I think what would be fun to do would be to have both of you read it with your two different interpretations. Because you really have two different ideas about how it might be done. Is there anything you can do to make it, to give it an extra kind of physicality?
You might have an idea of where the home is. I mean, the home might be this table, for example.
Yeah.
And feel, try to have some feeling for that, as you might have had for a girlhood home that, mm-hmm. that you remember with fondness.
Yeah. Do you want a brother? You can have a brother.
I says.
Yeah.
You have a brother, and you can have a brother and a sister. Yeah. So maybe you want to actually physically move around and...
Okay, Eden is that old-fashioned house that we dwell in every day, without suspecting that our abode, until we drive away. Oh, no, I had messed that up.
Take your time with it.
You're doing
Take
fine.
Your time with it. Take your time with it.
Okay. Eden is that old-fashioned house that we dwell in every day, without suspecting our abode until we drive away. How fair, on looking back, the day we sauntered from the door, unconscious our returning, discover it no more.
Yeah.
It's really the last two lines that are the tricky ones.
Unconscious our journey.
We're not aware that we can't discover it again.
Oh, we walk away.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And we've got this. And we walk away from it and think it's going to be...
And at that moment, you're unconscious that you can come.
Exactly. You just assume it'll be there just as it was.
Right.
When you come back, it's much smaller and dingier, and your brother and sister have changed. They've moved on in years, and they no longer are as involved with you. They've perhaps formed their own families, and it's not the same as it was at all. You had no idea that that would be the case.
Mm-hmm.
Because perhaps you just went away to college or to school, as she did in Mount Holyoke, and you didn't realize that you were making any final burst break from the house, but you now look back and you realize you were. You were.
Certainly a lot easier to understand when you act them out, isn't it?
It is indeed, which is why we like to do this, because it's a good way then to, anytime you're working with a poem or something of that sort, to try to act it out, and it really brings it home to you what it's about. And it's fun to do. It's fun to do, particularly with her poems, which are so concise and so chock full that you only come to realize all the levels of meaning if you try to act them out and you think about them in those terms.
And this little poem that I did about the bird and the nest, you ever watched a bird build a nest just twig by twig or stick by stick, thread by thread? See, this too probably had to work on her love. I mean, Emily had to love her for months. Maybe she didn't really think much of her when she saw her. So as a bird is building her nest, every time they were together or every conversation they had, she'd say, I think I'm going to like you. So it's just addition.
It's gradual.
Yeah, gradual addition. This
exactly.
would be building the nest.
Yeah.
Well, you had an observation, sir.
I had a reaction to it, and it maybe simply because I've been thinking about this concept a lot for the last year or two, but it seems very common in history for the poets to say things which appear 50 or 100 years later in the mouths of scientists and pseudoscientists, but the ideas of both Einsteinian physics and Gestalt therapy are very strong in this poem to me, because what it says is that we can only exist in the here and now, that that our failure as human beings is the inability to fully experience it, our life as it happens, as it flows, and that when we look back, we feel a sense of loss and nostalgia because we can't we may begin to understand the significance of the event, but we can't recapture the feelings. We really can't go back and re-experience it. And those are the ideas that appeared, you know, when Pearls and General Schmutz got together and talked about the here and now. And the other concept that is the continuum of life. It's the same yeah. thing. There's a grid. An event is a place that never can recur in the continuum, and we can only yeah. talk about it after it's happened.
Yeah, I mean that. It seems to me those last two lines are absolutely amazing mm-hmm. in how they move through time.
Read them.
Yeah. This is talking about when you leave home, okay. unconscious. Which is at the moment that you're leaving home, our returning, which is going to be in the future,
doesn't happen.
But discover it,
no more.
But find what we had before, mm-hmm. no more. So it moves from now to the future to the past again, with just those few words. Unconscious, our returning, but discover it no more.
Mm-hmm. The pull between return and discover. Mm-hmm. You may return, but you don't discover it. Mm-hmm. It's different.
Mm-hmm. You return to a different place.
You return to a different mm-hmm. place. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, isn't that always true of everything? I mean, we've all had this feeling that you don't appreciate it when you have it, and sometime in your life you think, I should have paid more attention, or I really had it good then and didn't know it. This is lost, the yearning.
Yes, indeed.
That you were speaking of.
Yes, indeed.
Because we lack appreciation for the thing at the time.
I remember when I was an ambitious, young, 28-year-old man, my father was doing things and starting a family and getting married to Annie and changing jobs and charging around the world. My life was intense, I remember. And he said, don't be in such a hurry. Savor. Savor these things. Savor having your first child. Take time. Don't be in such a hurry. It'll all happen. And I didn't really know what he meant. I said,
well, I remember.
Now I know.
I remember when all my friends were going to work and finishing their degrees, and I said, it's just hard as hell to stay home. But I'm not going to miss out on raising my own kids.
No.
Mm-hmm. And there's a price to pay for that, but yes. yeah. I just need that, knew that.
Yeah.
And that's one of the things in my life I've never regretted.
Good. Mm-hmm. So you had a different thought about the poems.
Well, I don't know if I can read it.
Just try. Just give it a go.
Eden is that old-fashioned house we dwell in every day, without suspecting our abode until we drive away. How fair I'm looking back, the day we sauntered from the door. Unconscious, our return will discover it no more. I'm not very good at poetry, just words.
Can you give it some pictures? Or even walk.
Eden is that old-fashioned house we dwell in every
just
day.
Just walk around
without
with
suspecting
it. Yeah.
Our abode until we drive away. How fair I'm looking back the day we sauntered from the door. Unconscious, our returning, but discover it no more.
Give yourself a house. You can make the door of the house.
Try again.
Yeah, and just do it. Let's move this.
Eden is that old-fashioned we dwell in every day.
Okay, so just make it. You can tell me the poem.
Without suspecting our abode until we drive away. How fair I'm looking back the day we sauntered from the door. Unconscious our returning, discover it no more.
Uh-huh. It is good.
Alive.
It is good.
It is good.
It is good.
Yeah.
It's alive.
It's kind of live to me.
Yeah.
Somebody at one time asked Robert Frost, I think I may have mentioned this to some of you, if a certain series of
like everybody is a theologian.
There you go.
Everybody can draw.
There you go.
Yeah, everybody can draw. Go first, or?
This is a. I want to be a gentleman.
Yours was on the.
I'm on the fame and you're on success.
Ah, oh, why don't you go on fame first?
After the first shock of finding the word was misspelled. I'm still not that sure of myself. Fame of myself to justify, all other plaudit be superfluous, and incense beyond necessity. Fame of myself to lack, although my name be else supreme. There were an honor, ominous, a futile diadem.
Come on to Jan's and then let's see what we got. Success is counted sweetest by those who ne'er succeed. To comprehend the nectar requires the sorest need. Not one of all the purple host who took the flag today can tell the definition so clear of victory as he defeated, dying on whose forbidden ear, the distant strains of triumph burst agonized and clear.
Nice.
Okay. Comments and the poems?
The Purple Horde.
Host.
Host.
Oh, host.
Yeah. I don't know what that's referring to. I don't believe.
Well, a host. I think we're in a situation of victory.
Yeah.
So what might the host be then?
I thought communion at first.
The army.
A host of men.
But
the army. So why would they be purple?
That's why.
Royal.
Yes, they are royal. Why are they royal?
Because they're Holy Cross College and Holy Cross won. I didn't mean to interrupt.
I didn't hear you.
Good. What did you say?
I said because they're the winners.
Yes.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So having won, you see, in this hypothetical, metaphorical battlefield, they immediately assume the mane of the rulers.
Yeah.
Yes, they now have the vanquished at their feet, and they are royal. They have absolute power over them.
Thank
therefore
you.
They are royal. So the purple host would be
the only thing that bothers me is the dying word. I keep thinking this has to be somewhere around the Civil War. You know, as he defeated dying, wherever those dashes are, on whose forbidden ear. He wasn't supposed to hear all this. Apparently.
Well, he is hearing it though, but maybe it's the last thing he ever hears, Jen.
Yeah, he's dying.
Right. So that makes the victory all the more dear that he has been deprived of.
Yeah.
Because not only is he defeated, but in his quest, he. So how sweet could that mantle of victory be not only has he lost the battle, but it's his last battle. So he's never going to be a victor.
And the others who won, they'll never realize.
They'll move on to the next battle.
That's right.
Without thinking much about it.
For the war.
Yeah. Always leave a few on the field.
Yeah.
Yeah. But I think it can be the
Olympic star. The Olympic star.
The Olympic star, it could be a defeat in an election.
Yeah, it can be lots of those things.
Yeah. It could be, I mean, I think whatever works for you is a strong image. It could be, what works for me is auditioning for a role and not being cast. And then all the people who are cast in this show are over there. And they've all got purple costumes. And it feels like dying.
It does feel like
dying. It feels like dying. Yeah.
Isn't that a stage phrase? I die down on the stage.
Right, yes, yeah.
Well, and think then of those who've got the roles. I'm sure we've all had experiences, have we not, of having gained something that you really wanted, and now you've got it, and you think about it, and people are congratulating you, but then they all leave, and you say, what's the big deal?
Isn't that Bill's?
That's
so that's Bill's phone.
That's Bill's phone.
Right.
Well, but success is counted sweetest by those who ne'er succeed, and then we're comparing those who haven't succeeded with those. Not one of all the purple hosts who took the flag today can taste the victory as sweetly as he who failed and who is defeated and who's dying. Now, those purple host types, they, it's no big deal. Well, it's okay, so we won.
Yeah.
But I thought it would be more satisfactory.
That's right.
You get the role, and now you say, well, gee, I've got the role, but you know, it's not such a great role. I really read it.
I've been through that one.
Boy, I wish I'd got the lead role. That's the one that I really would have. Okay, I'll go and play it, but...
Benny, don't leave.
I'm sorry, I have to leave. It's not that I don't like it.
We understand.
I think that's true of most any goal that you attain.
Yeah.
You get it, so what?
Here I am. So.
So what? Why did they make such a big deal of it now that I've got it? Glad I have it, I guess, but why did I make it so important? If I hadn't got it, it wouldn't matter very much. False. Would have mattered a lot.
So let's try Bill's poem again, because I think that's
a little harder.
You want me to read it?
Yeah, read it again. Okay. And try reading it as a comforting poem to her.
I thought it was for myself.
Well, try it, but it's so much to yourself that I'm not getting it.
Okay.
Yeah, so one of the tricks of getting a poem out, getting any kind of performance out, is simply to direct it very specifically to somebody else.
I just got home, right? Fame of myself to justify, all other plaudits be superfluous, and incense beyond necessity. Fame of myself to lack, although my name is else supreme, this was an honor, honorless, a futile diadem.
Yeah.
So let's just try the two of them. You've won.
She lost.
And she lost. Mm. And
not only has he won, but he is himself very proud of what's transpired. Or you could do it the other way too, Bill. The newspaper headline reads, Bill Cape vanquishes all. But you know that it was actually a setup, and you didn't feel that you played very well, that you performed as well as you were capable of doing. So the fact that headline and your picture there with the cup is in everybody's living room having breakfast this morning. The fact is that you know that it was really a setup.
Actually, Jen should be reading this one.
Well, oh yeah.
Okay. You want to switch? You want to switch?
No.
Would that be interesting to switch?
No, because the point is that when I get a little success, I kind of, well, good. When she gets a success, she says, well, it's what much.
Okay, well, first, let's do it first straight, and then let's switch them and have them tell it to each other, because I think that'd be very interesting.
I'll go ahead.
It doesn't work if you go first, because then it's not in any way comforting to her.
Okay.
But if she goes first and she's really broken up, then you can comfort her.
Success is counted sweetest by those who ne'er succeed. To comprehend a nectar requires the sorest need. Not one of all the purple host who took the flag today can tell the definition of so clear a victory as he defeated dying, on whose forbidden ear the distant strains of triumph first agonized and clear.
Poor soul. Fame of myself to justify, all other plaudit be superfluous, and incense beyond necessity. Fame of myself to lack, although my name is else supreme, this was an honor, honorless, a futile diadem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Interesting.
Okay, let's switch them.
Okay.
Yeah,
I'm going
to say the same thing,
right? So now who's the victor? She's the victor. I am. Victory. Close, yeah. Fame of myself to justify all other plaudit be superfluous and incense beyond necessity. Fame of myself to lack, although my name be else supreme, this were an honor, honorless, a futile diadem.
Success is counted sweetest by those who ne'er succeed. To comprehend the nectar requires sorest need. Not one of all the purple host who took the flag today, can tell the definition so clear of victory. So he defeated, dying, on whose forbidden ear the distant strains of triumph first agonized and clear.
Nice. Yeah.
Try it once more. Annoyed at each other. Okay. I mean, it's interesting because the success is counted sweetest can really be a real dig at the person who succeeded.
That's what I felt about it.
Yeah.
Should he be first?
I thought she was a little puffed up about it.
Okay.
Condescending.
Yeah.
Yeah. You can go first.
Yes, I won the cup, but...
it wasn't me.
Yeah, it wasn't anything.
Actually, right. Did you see the competition? There wasn't anybody there. Really, a lot of fighting games.
Yeah, that's what I was getting. So you really... Then I thought he was really going to go after you. What do you mean? I would have given anything. Get that thing away from her. I'll tell you what, do the poem taking off this thing. You know, it's nothing. Yeah, actually use the sweater as the symbol of victory, both of you.
Oh.
Okay.
Should I go first then?
So you go first and take it off and, you know, just throw it away. It doesn't mean anything.
theme of myself to justify, all other plaudit be superfluous, and incense beyond necessity. Theme of myself.
No, wait, I'm going to stop you.
Oh. Not doing that? What is this?
This is what she wants.
Yeah, it's what you wanted. So you don't just sort of casually put it on your lap. And I think, but you are casual. You may just throw it on the floor.
Okay.
Maybe you want to stand up.
Okay.
Yeah, stand up, take it off. Yeah. So anything like that, then when you touch it, it's hugely significant.
Yeah.
It's just, you know, I'm sorry.
Theme of myself to justify all other plaudit be superfluous and incense beyond necessity. Theme of myself to lack, although my name be else supreme. This were an honor, honorless, a futile diadem. Mm.
When she says this were an honor, honorless, that's when she should be, Madam Director.
Oh, really?
Yeah, this is an honor.
Oh, yeah.
Honor, yeah. Honorless.
That's what I see there.
Very good. Very good.
Yeah. It's like, I don't want it anyway. It doesn't mean a thing to me, see?
Yeah, exactly.
Okay. Theme of myself to justify all other plaudit be superfluous. And incense beyond necessity. Fame of myself to lack, although my name be else supreme. This were an honor, honorless.
Success is counted sweetest by those who ne'er succeed. To comprehend the nectar requires the sorest need. Not one of all the purple host who took the flag today can tell the definition so clear of victory.
A victory, maybe you hold the sweater up and you say, a clear, a victory, that's it, that's victory.
I would sense you'd want to throw it back.
I do too. I would be so pissed at her.
Just mean anything to you, don't put on me.
I'll do the last play. Not
just more. Start it again.
All right.
Yeah. I mean, here she is.
Okay.
Yeah.
Down here.
Did she just...
Success is counted sweeter by those who ne'er succeed. To comprehend the nectar requires the sorest need. Not one of all the purple host who took the flag today can tell the definition of victory. So clear, the definition of so clear of victory.
Good.
As he defeated dying, on whose forbidden near the distant strains of triumph burst agonizing and agonized in prayer.
Yeah, good.
Yeah.
Yeah, she's still hard to say.
That's good. So do we have some more? We have some more.
More poems?
Anybody else do them?
And then we found there are two more verses to the sister poems.
Oh,
the
really?
Sister poems. Yeah.
And it's on the in the chair.
It's in the chair and
both of them.
It's in Johnson. So. Why don't you read
that big book? Is it available anymore?
Oh yeah, sure.
Yeah.
You can buy
that. Yeah, and it's in the library here.
Oh, it is.
Yeah.
Do you teach this has this is
no, I have taught it a lot.
Oh, yeah.
I'm not teaching it now.
Clear punctuation.
Oh.
Yeah. It's later. I mean.
Yeah, it's in this big book.
Yeah,
it wasn't in the book I read from.
So they're different editions.
And the editions go on and on.
And there is now at Harvard a whole study being done, which presumably will be the final
Well, not sure that would be funny.
I was amazed at the video that this really didn't start till 1950.
Yeah,
all this research.
55. Well, there was work going forward, but it wasn't culminating until 55 when Johnson brought out this book. Sir?
Oh, no, no. I've just been looking at your stuff up there.
Okay, we can discuss that if you like.
Let's do the sister poem to get the whole one and get the two other verses.
Sure.
It's funny that we only had four in that book, isn't it?
Well,
no,
this book isn't necessarily giving the full poems. And the Bianchi book is an earlier version where Emily Dickinson's niece chopped verses out if she didn't understand
it's
them.
It's in the Bianchi, but it doesn't have the same punctuation.
Bianchi changed them and changed the punctuation, and they didn't put the dashes in. They talked about the dashes yesterday, how putting the dashes in gave it kind of a breathless quality, and it was the way Dickinson wrote it. She always put those dashes in. But now they're always included.
A breathless quality.
Yeah. So read the whole thing?
Read the whole thing, and then
we get those.
One sister have I in our house, and one a hedge away. There's only one recorded, but both belong to me. One came the road that I came and wore my last year's gown. The other as a bird, her nest, to build with our hearts among. She did not sing as we did. It was a different tune. Herself to her a music, as bumblebee of June. Today is far from childhood, but up and down the hills, I held her hand the tighter, which shortened all the miles. And still I hear her hum, the years among deceives the butterfly. Still in her eyes, the violets lie, moldered this many May. I split the dew and took the morn. I chose this single star from out the wide night's numbers.
Sue, forevermore.
Sue, her sister-in-law.
Susan, she was called Sue.
Yeah. So, and then you said there was a rift in the later on.
Yes, there was indeed.
What happened to her as the wife? Are you going to tell us the rest of the story?
Well, I certainly will.
Good.
It was just not a very happy marriage from the outset. Mm-hmm.
This is Sue and Austin.
Sue and Austin, yes. And there have been books written about it. There is a very good book about, which is called Austin and Mabel. Mabel Loomis Todd was the lover of Austin.
Oh.
Aha!
These ropes were cast.
You were coming in the fall.
They are. So there was a kind of a war then between the two houses because Lavinia and Emily really took Austin's side and helped him in the affair that he had with Mabel,
who was
a young faculty wife of Amherst College, Austin being the treasurer of the college, which was the number two academic officer and an extremely important post. He was the most important man in the town. And the two sisters were devoted to him, absolutely devoted to him all their lives. It was a very tight family. And Susan just never made Austin a happy person. It was just not a good marriage at all. And he was, on the other hand, very, very happy with Mabel. And the affair went on for 13 years.
Wow.
A shocking thing in New England towns, mm-hmm. in a Victorian, New England, Old Testament type town. But the affair went on until he died. Hmm. He died, and the rift was very, very strong. Very acrimonious, and Emily and Vinnie had very little to do with Susan because they had chosen Austin. It was just that kind of a relationship, which today would lead to divorce almost in 90% of the cases, but in that time it was just divorce was unconscionable, it was not even conceivable.
But they were very imaginative in the way they worked it all out.
Yes, they were.
And actually established a kind of ménage à trois.
Sounded like
her husband.
Yeah. Right. Sounded like a real spousal relationship between Austin and Emily and Vinny.
Yeah.
Yes.
And a sort of a harem idea where the jealousy didn't play a Western role.
No, that's right. That's right. It wasn't jealousy at all. Both the sisters were fond of Mabel, who was a charming young, vivacious woman, who was one of the pair, interestingly enough, and this is one of the most significant facts, that Mabel is one of the two who finally published Emily Dickinson's poems. Vinnie urged it. Vinnie urged the publishing on Sue. Vinnie urged the publishing on everybody that she thought might publish them. She was wild to get them published.
Sue wouldn't.
Well, Sue didn't.
He wouldn't
Sue
want
didn't.
It. You need
right.
the family.
Yeah, right. But Mabel did, and with Thomas Higginson got the first poems out, which then immediately caused enormous interest, and they were, that was the first of the really important literary developments in Emily's coming to the public's attention, which all her life she had been like a moth around a light bulb by herself, and decided that she would not publish. So it's a very tangled and fascinating story, which I commend to you. And the best account of it is this biography by Sewell, Richard Sewell, who was kind of the main commentator in the video that we saw yesterday, mm-hmm. the balding senior gentleman.
Mm-hmm. The clean-shaven man.
Clean-shaven man, yeah. And this biography is written, as I think I mentioned to some of you, in a fascinating form. It's in two volumes. The first volume is not about Emily Dickinson. The first volume is about Sue, and her brother, and Vinnie, and the father, and the mother. It starts talking about the grandfather, the paternal grandfather, Edward Dickinson's father, who was really the founding father of Amherst College, which is a splendid, as you probably know, small liberal arts college. So it tells all about all the town and relationships. And then the second volume, the bigger book, is about Emily. Magnificent biography. I think it's probably one of the two great literary biographies that I know. And then there is a separate book written by a woman named Polly Longworth, which I also commend to your attention, which is the one called Mabel and Austin and Mabel, which tells the story of this relationship right through to the publishing of the poems.
Tell me, what was Mabel's husband doing all this time?
He was an astronomer on the faculty of Amherst College himself.
He worked nights.
It was an amazing 1990s open marriage. He was a philanderer himself.
Oh.
And this was not a problem for Mabel. They really had an open marriage.
She was relieved.
Yes, and then she fell in love with Austin, and Mabel's husband did not disapprove of the relationship. Indeed, for a time in Amherst, Massachusetts, they had a ménage à trois.
Oh, gosh. What did the community think?
The community was properly outraged and gossiped.
How many people here have lived in academic communities?
I thought you were going to ask how many people have lived in Ménage.
I'd like to remind everybody here that this is on tape.
we have a brief break to tell Mary's Ménage à trois.
We don't want this break. Okay.
I suppose so.
On video, too.
I mean, the audio tape.
So
well, I just put those up there to make you think about them.
So we're okay.
We have till 4.
We have till 4.
I just put those up there because they're...
But if you would like to stretch for a minute.
What do we make of these two? One's a pair of lines and the one is a single line.
Well, I look at that first and I interpret it two different ways. We may think somebody has a lot of strength not knowing their weakness, not discovering it or not being aware of their weakness. We think they're real teller. And I also look at it in a way that maybe we think of ourselves as strong, not recognizing our own weaknesses.
Is that a problem? Not to discover weakness is the mystery of strength.
How do you interpret it, Jen?
Well, I'm just thinking in the relationship, the women that I've worked with over the years that have gone into the, you know, that really become intense about the women's movement and liberation. They, like this one young woman the other night at the forum, starts out with, I know I'm good, or I know I can do it. I have no problem with myself. Because that's kind of been the way in the movement, is that women have had to say that to themselves to get over the feeling of feeling inferior and weak and in the situation, and not to discover weakness is the mystery of strength. Maybe we see weaknesses in men, they don't have the slightest idea that they have them. You know, they don't want to admit to them, or I don't know. I just related that type of thing. Maybe I'm wrong, but I mean that was a mystery, and it is kind of good not to always think of your weakness. Women are overwhelmed with weaknesses at times.
Yeah.
But why do you have to affirm? I'm really good. Why do you have to say that?
I just said that.
I know, but why does a person who begin to speak
just
that way?
Like black is beautiful.
Huh.
Just constantly affirming yourself when you're in a field that you're in an impressive situation.
But that's sort of inferiority complex, isn't it?
Women have inferiority complex, and so do black. You know, that's the problem. Yeah. They're kind of crawling over.
They
may be totally wrong and have the wrong impression. There are men who have inferiority complex too, but that isn't a manly thing to reveal.
No.
Now, I would look at that and say, you see some very important, famous person, and they look like they have nothing but looks good, because you don't know their weaknesses.
That's kind of what I was thinking.
Yeah.
It reminded me of that. Oh, I'm sorry.
I was just going to say, I think that, to me, it means that it's talking about the terribly debilitating effect of self-doubt. Confidence is not necessarily aggressive, but it is utterly impossible to accomplish anything if you're trying to accomplish it. The two terms are mutually exclusive. You either do something or you don't, and if you're trying to do it, you haven't done it. You're not doing it while you're trying. And the real mystery that she's talking about is the fact that people really are able to do things that objectively they might not seem capable of, but they do so because they are confident that they can, and they simply do it. And that is the mystery of their strength, the fact that they are not debilitated by self-doubt.
The thing that I thought was, you've heard the story about the person who lifted a car off of a child that was pinned under it. He didn't think, I'm not strong enough to do this.
Yeah.
But the mystery was, how did I do this?
He didn't even think about it at the time.
Right.
He was doing
it was a mystery to him. It would ever be to all of us. Mm-hmm. That the strength was there. Because he did not say, I can't do it. I might as well let him. There's nothing I can do. This child's going to die or whatever.
Not to discover weakness. It didn't even occur to him that he was weak.
Exactly.
He knows he had not yet. If you think of the word discover, it had not come to his consciousness the possibility that he could be too weak to lift.
Right. Discover
can go both ways, right? I mean, it can be both a transitive and an intransitive. Discover can be used as meaning to show.
Yes.
As well as to find.
Mm. Yeah, that's good.
Mm-hmm.
Shakespeare uses it to show.
It's interesting that it's discover rather than recognize.
Yeah.
Discover is an interesting word there.
It is.
Discover.
It is.
Yeah, you play with that one.
Her choices of words are usually pretty thoughtful.
And you know, there are people like that. They really don't see
the bad or the weakness in people, all they see is their amazing strength. It's like the kids for some people. They just discovered that side of them.
I remember when Hillary climbed Everest with the Sherpa and reading about the capacity of those Sherpas to lift these enormous loads at altitudes above 20,000 feet, as though, of course you carry that, you pick that up and you carry it up to the top of Everest, when we would say, and medical doctors among us would say, a man is not capable, a woman is not capable of taking that load up that, because the capability is there, is the limitation of oxygen, doesn't feed into, et cetera, the muscle is not, you can't, scientifically, no way, and they don't know that, so they do it.
Exactly.
Sarah?
I was involved in an accident, a car accident one time, and I walked around, the car was knocked up on the side, I walked around on the other side, there was a child's arm protruding from underneath the car, and there was nobody else there very close, and I picked the car up and held it up for about 6 inches off the pavement for some 15 or 20 seconds until some men who were running over helped me, and we set the car upright. And I could, I mean, it would be absurd to think that I could lift a car. I couldn't do it for $1 million or for any kind of reward, but it never occurred to me that I couldn't. It was something that really had to be done. And it's a very fascinating experience to after the fact, realize that you've done something that you know perfectly well you can't do. That's where I saw it.
That's good.
Yeah. Sherpa guide has died, by the way.
I guess he did just recently, didn't he? Yeah, I think that's probably why I thought of it. I read the comments. That's interesting.
But they've been living in that altitude too, which probably gives them an amazing ability to.
Accustomed to it.
But they don't live that high.
They don't live anything like that high, right? They don't go that high. Any other thoughts on that one? If not, maybe we look at the second. What the?
It made me think of that exercise that you do when you.
You hold your arm out.
Oh, right. Someone can't bend it.
Somebody can't bend it.
If you just relax and you put all the energy at the end.
Exactly.
It can't be.
Tighten it up, they can break it.
Yeah.
Because you haven't discovered
it. You want to demonstrate?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Who wants to do it?
Sure.
Okay.
Go,
yeah. Okay. Okay, so.
Well, let's see. How do you do it? Here. You're going to try and.
Do you want me to try to put it down now?
Yeah.
Okay. Are you, is it stiff now?
It's just relaxed.
It's just relaxed. Cannot bend her arm.
And she's relaxing.
She's
Come on. Yeah. See, you can do it. You have to control my arm.
Tell me what you're doing.
Oh, you can actually put it on mine and let her try to do it.
Okay, now you're supposed to bend your arm, Jim.
Tell me when.
You're supposed to break my arm down.
Okay, when?
Anytime.
That's amazing.
Gee, that's amazing. And I'm
not that strong. Well,
tell me. What do you do?
She's not discovering weakness.
You missed your strength.
Tell me how to do it.
Okay.
What do you do? What do you do with it?
Just relax it.
Yeah.
Don't relax it. Don't try it.
Put your energy.
I didn't even talk about putting my energy anywhere.
Yeah, I think about putting my energy in the hand.
But it works
either
way.
It works
either
way.
And now I can't do it.
I've seen something.
When you went to pick up the car, you weren't
thinking, I've got to pick up my car.
No, I was really...
You were picking up the car.
Yeah, I was really in the here and now.
Yeah.
Thinking about the child.
Thinking about the child, and all the energy was going into what had to be done, and not into being concerned about what...
No hurry or anything like that.
No, because the energy all went to the right place.
What's the...
It's a miracle.
Trying to...
Yeah, hurting was strange. That's right. You know, you get your body to do all these...
You must have...
The configuration of the car was such that it wasn't resting on the...
You must have had some tricky thoughts after this was over.
How about contention loves a shining mark? What do we make of that?
What is contention? I know that it's a word, but I'm...
Contention is argumentation, differences of opinion.
Contentious person.
A contentious person is an argumentative person, a person who takes the other view.
Yeah.
Almost automatically.
I think that, to me, that means that if there's an argument between two parties, that if there is some kind of a landmark that looks like solid evidence, that one can hang on as very, very important. That's what that means. If you find something like that to hang your argument around or on or attach it to it, that's why they love it, because they think they're winning their argument by just hanging on by this little guidepost or whatever.
Other thoughts on it?
My immediate response was, I've seen this, church congregations are a black church community. One of them excels, and everybody's cutting, when they cut him or her down. Where contention loves a shiny mark, they all focus on the one who did well.
One
who had
done well?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Who got a little fame.
I thought more maybe, I think was right.
A shining mark would be a famous person, perhaps. A person who is perhaps a leader, a person who has the aura of saintliness about him or her, perhaps, sanctified. Therefore, there may be a tendency to see something wrong, to take another view, to be critical.
We're critical of celebrities today.
Yeah.
We try to find dirt.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, that would be an example.
National Enquirer. Could perhaps have contention loves a shining mark as its logo, although I don't think
it would. Well, then it's kind of like jealousy. You...
Yes.
Yeah.
Sports figures have to stay out of bars because drunks will challenge them to fight.
Yeah.
Who's they'll select
sports figures, you know, people who are famous for their physical prowess. They're the ones that they can.
That's
right.
Yeah.
The old gunslingers.
Sure, that's right. Yeah, he doesn't. You don't go into the saloon and challenge a guy who hasn't got a reputation.
So, jealousy would be involved in it.
Jealousy and envy.
And envy, yeah.
Gee, we're getting good at this.
Well, when people, you know, or maybe if they haven't, well, Bill mentioned the black community among everyone, but I chaired the Jesse Jackson campaign, and most criticism of Jesse Jackson often come out of the black community, not the white community.
Yeah.
You know, they were looking, oh, he's just getting up there and wheeling and dealing with all the
people. Jesse Jackson would be a shining mark. He's handsome, he's an ex-football player, he's got a kind of a grace about him, he's got a kind of a regal quality about him, so he would be a shining mark. Interesting enough, I saw this line someplace and I was very taken with it. And I used it, and then I found I was writing a paper or something, and I wanted to use it, and so I had to find the citation. And I looked through her poetry. It's not the first line of a poem, and I had never seen it in its context. I'd just seen this line. And I can't tell you how long it took me to find it, and it turns out it's not in a poem. It was in a letter.
No.
It's a line, it certainly has a poetic meter, but it was in a letter that she wrote. It took me, I can't tell you how many hours to find it.
Is that where I couldn't find the one about routine? Because I
to make routine.
I looked through all my only Dickinson books one day. Finally, I called the library and they tracked it down. Is that not in the point either?
To make routine a stimulus, yeah. Remember it can cease?
I bet she wrote that in a letter.
It may very well have been a letter. Yeah,
because I
that was
find
a letter
that
also.
Book of all her poems, and I read it.
Because it's hard to find an internal line in a poem, 1,775 poems. That's when I looked for this. Through any
yeah,
poem that had any aura of contention about
true.
It.
True, I guess maybe I could have missed it, but I wonder if it's in a letter. But this wasn't in a letter.
I think maybe it was in a letter. The other one as well. Because she wrote so many letters.
So would there be a book on her letters?
Oh, yes, there is a book of her letters. But
that's separate from her poems. So.
Yes, oh, yes, indeed, yeah.
Tom, what is the official interpretation of that?
Contention loves to shine. Well, I don't think there is an official one.
We just made it up.
We have.
If you're in the Jesse Jackson campaign,
we're the official one. Thank you very much. We're the experts.
I was using it in work that I was doing about college presidents.
you used it when you were a college president.
Yeah. Well, I could use it when I was a college president, but I didn't have to get the citation then.
Right.
Nobody would say, Mr. College President, citation on that. I'd say, no, I won't. But when I wrote it, when I used it writing, in the book I was working on, then I had to get the citation, and I couldn't find it. And I found it in the letter. But a college president, or Scott, in this community, you see, he's a shining mark. He's the leader, he's
that's
the director,
right.
He's the chief, minister of a church, similarly. It's a,
you should have felt that.
He likes Caesar's wife above reproach, because any contention that might arise, will arise, because he or she is the shining mark. Audio tape?
Audio tape. It's a radio program.
Tell about the background.
It's a radio program.
It's short.
It's 8 minutes or something like that. Exactly how long it is. It's 8 minutes and 50 seconds. And this is a radio program. We'll probably want to listen to it a couple of times, and we'll probably want to go over the poems after the first time and get them in order. This is a radio program that I helped to make several years ago in celebration, or in commemoration, actually, of the death of Emily Dickinson, the 100th anniversary. And I had been working with a woman named Ruth McCree, who has performed here, on a production of the Belle of Amherst play, which was produced at the Snoqualmie Falls Outdoor Forest Theater.
I was just going to ask you that. Was that you helped her?
Yeah, I directed
this
that.
This summer?
No.
When was it?
That was
86.
86.
86, because it was
that.
Done at the 100th anniversary. This program was done, but you also thought
about it. Yeah, well, we weren't members until now again we're members.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, that's what I wondered, if it was this summer or what.
No, it was several summers ago. And so we did the Belle of Amherst, and then we thought, well, you know, we've been working on this Emily Dickinson stuff, we should do some more. So we thought it would be great fun to do a radio program, and that it would be interesting to use music on the radio program to really help one to hear the poems. So we worked with a very talented pair of musicians, Mark Heineman and Rachel Warwick, who wrote music to go with the poems that we chose. We all chose the poems together. I mean, we spent a long time choosing the poems. We chose the poems that would be particularly appropriate for this approach. And then they wrote music to enhance the listening experience of the poems. And then we went into a recording studio. This was my first experience really doing anything that needed such precise recording. I mean, I'd done a lot of recording of commercials and that kind of stuff. But I'd never done anything that was sort of an art recording. And this 8 and 50 second tape took us 20 hours of studio time working with a wonderful engineer. He had 16 different tracks. The musicians had, well, a space this big, you know, the space of our circle, that was just filled with all kinds of instruments and musical sounding things, so that they would record one track, and then we would play it again, and they would record another track, so that, you know, it sounds like they have 16 musicians playing sometimes, but it's actually laid in at different times. And it was a fascinating experience for all of us involved. So we'll listen through, and then we can talk a bit about it and talk about the poems. It was played on National Public Radio, various stations. Seattle and Amherst, we know.
Celebration of the poetry of Emily Dickinson.
A little madness in the spring was wholesome even for the king, but God be with the clown who ponders this tremendous thing. Wild experiment of green, as if it were his own. Bee, I'm expecting you. Was saying yesterday to somebody you know that you were due. The frogs got home last week, or settled in at work. Birds? Mostly back, the clover warm and thick. You'll get my letter by the 17th. Reply. Or better, be with me. Yours, fly. The bobolink is gone, the rowdy of the meadow, and no one swaggers now but me. The Presbyterian birds can now resume the meeting he boldly interrupted that overflowing day when, supplicating mercy in a portentous way, he swung upon the Decalogue and shouted, "Let us pray!" I dined for beauty, but was scarce adjusted in the tomb when one who died for truth was laid in an adjoining room. He questioned softly why I failed. For beauty, I replied, and I for truth. Those are one. We brethren are, he said. And so, as kinsmen met at night, we talked between the rooms until the moss had reached our lips and covered up our names.
See if we can play it one more time on a sound system that, will be better for a group this size in a space this big. And I think we then can start and maybe talk about some of the poems and talk a little more about this production, because one of the things that we're trying to do, just to reiterate, is to show how the body of her poetry can be used through other mediums. Film, television, dance, radio, theater, etc. And it's kind of fun to explore the ways in which good artists have taken up her poetry and have made it their own, which is a further healthy expansion of the use of her words, her simple words written on those little fascicles and pieces of paper now are being broadcast and spread through the country and the world through these various mediums. It's fun to explore that.
Well, for closing, why don't I just read Richard Sewell's letter, the man who did this two-volume biography, who was in the video. Because it's such a nice letter. It's so much fun. We send him a copy.
There was some specific reason, but I can't remember what the specific reason was, but we just wanted him to have a copy. I mean, that was the real reason.
He being the giant.
He being the giant. He being the primary.
Of the Dickinson scholars.
Johnson.
Exam copy of what, the tape?
Of the tape, yeah. And so then he wrote back on, you know, kind of stationery that people have, with his address in Bethany, Connecticut, and he said, "Thanks for those fine 8 minutes. Should have been 80. But we should be grateful for what the media gives us. Isn't it great to see ED coming into our own?" and then we had a program of events which took place at the Folger Museum in Washington, the Shakespeare Museum, which is owned by Amherst College and so also has a lot of Dickinson material. And he had been part of that commemorative event. Also,
but it's Washington, D.C.
Washington, D.C.
Another Washington.
Right. So he said, and we must have asked him something about it. "The affair at the Folger and the Monday following at the Smithsonian was heartwarming. Folger sold out a month in advance, Smithsonian SRO 500 people. The National Public Radio interview was a break. Glad you liked it. I, of course, thought only of my gravelly voice and of all the things I wish I'd said. Also, Voice of America nabbed me for one. What they did with it, I don't know. They promised it would go to 46 countries. Big contribution of your 8 minutes was, for me, getting me back to that wonderful Better Than Music poem. I'd all but forgotten it. Isn't that true of ED? You think you've got her all in hand, and then you come upon a poem that hits you as if you'd never read it before. A tiny demur about the reading of the poems. A bit too dramatic, wistful, plaintive, in short, the kind of reading Julie Harris put in vogue." then he has a little, in pen, he puts along here, "at times."
That's to be nice.
That's to be nice. Sternhagen, Francis Sternhagen, mm-hmm. Who gave two evenings of readings at the Folger, fell, I thought, into the same mode. Plus a slightly English accent! Exclamation point. The reason for the mode is that these readers are all experienced actresses who bring too many stage mannerisms to the poems. ED is not like that, I'd say. She's more direct, even virile, stronger. Quote, "My life has been too simple and stern to embarrass any," end quote, she said to Higginson. Emphasis on stern, he underlined stern. "But this is a minor quibble. The 8 minutes was beautifully produced, and I like the music especially, and the interesting selection of poems. Congratulations and thanks, sincerely, Richard Sewell." Which I think is great fun. I mean, that's the sort of criticism you often get from scholars when you try to put their work onto the stage. And also poets often feel that the poems should just be read very simply.
The point of
sacredly.
Secretly incomprehensibly.
Sacredly.
Simply.
Sacredly.
Sacredly. Yeah.
You can be attached to her and writing.
My approach is, of course, somewhat different. Mm-hmm. But anyway, it's such a nice letter. Mm-hmm.
The readings that we heard yesterday on the video were very straight on. Very uninflected,
very
untheatrically, and Annie said she had trouble with them because they were almost boring, especially if the meaning eluded one right at the outset. One tended to lose one's concentration, and that is the danger of having it too head-on, too straight, too simple, without sufficient inflection, which Ruth McCrea gets lots of in there. They're the two schools of thought. Mm-hmm. For oral interpretation of literature, which is one of the things that we're exploring here, by the way, in case you want a fancy, highfalutin title for it, this would be a course in the college, which would be called Oral Interpretation of Literature.